Welcome to our whistleblower world at Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and constant whistleblower advocate. We look into the lives of whistleblowers or their advocates, brave souls who are prophets of conscience. President Biden has referred to whistleblowers in the highest of praise, referring to them as accountability actors. I just refer to whistleblowers as heroes.
So today we have Jackie Garrett. And Jackie, not only besides being professional, compassionate, kind, understanding, and a veteran, she also runs Whistleblowers of America. She is an exceptional human being. She is a whistleblower extraordinaire. She's also what we refer to as a legacy whistleblower. She's been in the arena a long time. So we're going to start, Jackie, and welcome. We're going to start with your military service. Tell us a little bit about this because you are a veteran.
Correct, yes. So I joined the Army after actually spending a few years working with Vietnam combat veterans and getting to be acquainted with post-traumatic stress disorder as it was a new diagnosis in the 1980s when we were starting what we were calling young vet programs then. And we were just beginning to, I think the work with combat vets and PTSD and understanding it as a diagnosis was really just kind of taking off. And so that shaped a lot of my early career in learning how to understand and assess combat trauma and suicide among veterans returning from Vietnam and their family issues.
And the family issues. And Jackie, I think you've mentioned this before, but do you see kind of the similarities between a veteran and whistleblowers in the PTSD area or the symptom area? Do you see the same kind of things being suffered by both groups?
Yeah, so that was my aha moment. Ah. I had woken up from a nightmare, the cold sweats, all the things we talk about with combat veterans. And it was like, oh my gosh, my heart was racing. I mean, you know those kinds of nightmares. And I thought, this is PTSD. This is what it feels like on the inside, not just what it's like on the outside. And then I was having a conversation with another female veteran. She was law enforcement, federal law enforcement, not FBI. But she was another, I believe, federal agent. And she was talking about having a gun on her table and thinking about suicide. And so my next phone call was to an attorney. And I said, we have to incorporate Whistleblowers of America. We had been playing with the idea, thinking it through. What was it? What was it going to look like? What was the business model? What was going to be the strategic plan? And I just said, I don't know. We're going to figure this out, but we have to do something. The same techniques of peer support that I've seen work with combat veterans, I believe will work with whistleblowers.
And so what year was that, Jackie?
So we started Whistleblowers of America in 2017. We did the actual incorporation.
And you yourself are a whistleblower.
Right.
And can you tell us something about what you blew the whistle on? And I assume, did you self-diagnose your PTSD or was there a professional that did that?
So that's a lot in one question.
Yes. Yes. Bless your heart. You have as much time as you want, Jackie.
So my whistleblowing experience started in about 2014 when I felt there was a conflict of interest for another senior person at the Defense Department and the contracts we had for suicide prevention. When I made my disclosures to her supervisor, and these were all very senior people, it spiraled. I mean, he believed me and he did something about it. I was there when he was making phone calls, so I know he actually took me seriously, believed me, and bless him, he did all the right things. He retired and passed away. So the only moment of salvation that I had was that there were other witnesses in the room with me when I made my disclosures. So they were able to talk about what had happened with OSC and provide me affidavits about the situation. But then moving forward, the next thing I knew, she was saying that I wasn't qualified for the position that I had created, that she recommended somebody else over me, that she was creating this hostility, disparaging, questioning the things we were doing, when she didn't have a mental health background. I don't even know if she had a college degree. Some people have said otherwise. So I was feeling, though, you know, I think I've heard somebody call it punching up, right? So you've got these much powerful people in an organization, and it's just become so easy to undermine you. And it was not on Discovery, but on a FOIA, that I got all of their emails, and all of this started to tell its own story, because then it was them in their own words about things they were saying. And that was the evidence I was able to present to a judge. Now, because I did recognize the PTSD and the symptoms and the anxiety and the depression, all those things that I was dealing with, I first went to an EAP counselor, and then I worked with a psychologist. And that's when I, you know, in going through sort of this process myself and going through my own therapy, I realized that there was a lot of this was very systemic. And I was not unique in this situation. No. And it was working with the psychologist and the tools that she was able to use and find to assess my PTSD were inadequate. So that's when, with her help and her guidance early on, I started to put together my own ability to understand the psychosocial impacts of trauma. But also, we needed to connect it back, because, you know, working with veterans, we know that the VA doesn't service connect you without a nexus to service. So our thought was that we needed a nexus to retaliation. And to do that, we needed a taxonomy for the retaliation. And that's what I've been working on and building, is that lexicon and that taxonomy to understand how does retaliation inform and lead to symptoms of PTSD or depression or other mental health conditions.
Jackie, is there anyone besides you that is working on this? Are you the only one out there working on this?
Well, I'd hate to say yes to that. But I know there are definitely other law firms and other professionals that I've talked to who get this, who understand, and I call it a mental health parity. We need to understand the damage of mental health when we're looking at damages. So we understand if somebody loses an arm in a wood chipper, we can assess above the elbow, below the elbow. We can understand rotation. Those are all degrees of disability. When it comes to mental health in general, those are harder things to assess. So even like for Social Security disability, those assessments are much harder to go through and to make and to understand loss of functionality, loss of occupation, the occupational impairment that mental health can cause. So we've really had to work on building that and building that community. I just recently found another great book by Jennifer Fraser called it's called The Bullied Brain. And it's all about how being bullied changes your brain chemistry. So, and I've worked with Martina Buck on a book we call Whistleblower Retaliation, the Psychosocial Impacts and the Workplace Promise. So when we looked at our book, we have pulled together now a lot of research from other people that have looked at how is retaliation traumatic? How does it have a psychological impact as well as a socioeconomic impact? an impairment to employability.
Now, Jackie, you keep saying we. Are there other people involved in this process?
So when I've worked on the book, I've worked with Dr. Martina Bach, who has been my co-author. We did an article originally with that came out in the journal for the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation in a journal on human resilience. We did a survey on the Whistleblowers of America website, and she helped me analyze the elements of the survey. And now we've taken that article and we have built out a book. And so when I talk to other psychologists that are in this space, it's really helpful, I think, to build out a profession. And it's nascent. I mean, I can probably off the top of my head think of about 5 or 10 people that I know are working in this field, as opposed to the hundreds of thousands that are working on combat trauma. I mean, there are over 40,000 nonprofits that focus on veterans and combat trauma. And there's probably, like I said, a handful of us globally that are working on whistleblower retaliation as a traumatic stressor.
Wow, you're the only one, Jackie, that I know of. Are you talking about Professor McClellan in the UK? Is he one of your five?
So I've talked to Nigel, yes.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Yes, and Kate Kenny and Mariana Pataki. Are in this space. Mary Inman as a lawyer, I think, understands damages. Jason Zuckerman is a lawyer. Mahari and Scalad, who sponsored us quite a bit. So there were definitely lawyers who get this as needing to really understand and promote the damages when these cases go forward. So sometimes I think people confuse the whistleblower reward programs and retaliation as pain and suffering and damages. And I'm more interested in the pain and suffering for the damages that a whistleblower goes through because of their moral injury, the impact to their identity, the identity disruption, the shattering of worldviews. I mean, these are all terms that the mental health profession understands. I just don't know that they have applied it well to the retaliation that an employee goes through, quite in the same way that if you're persecuted for your religious beliefs, we need to add that ethical conversation into the discussion on the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that the American Psychiatric Association publishes. They just did a fifth edition text revision. And I know I've written to them, I've asked them to consider retaliation. I've also written to Merriam-Webster Dictionary and Microsoft, asking them to change the definition of whistleblower, because it's all very negative, and that negativity adds to the stigma.
Right. And perpetrates it, doesn't it? It continues.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Victimizing the victim. So I'm interested in this book, Jackie. It has not been published yet.
We are so close.
Oh, you're so close. How close are you, Jackie? Tell me.
We keep going through legal reviews with Springer Nature is the publisher. So because we're talking about whistleblowers, and because there's always that concern about defamation, libel, slander, you know, all those terms, they've made us go through an added level of legal review. So outside counsel, we've had to hire outside counsel to review this book before we can get it published. Even though mostly what we're just talking about is the emotional aspects of retaliation. But like we took an article that's very much about Sharon Watkins and Enron, but we had to take out the name Enron from the article
avoid.
And now I just said it.
Yeah.
Probably shouldn't have done that.
And no, I think you should. I think you should.
I know, because Sharon's been on your show, right?
Yes.
And she's talked about Enron.
Yes, she has. And in fact, one of the questions that came up was what happened to Jeff Skelling, who was one of the leaders there at Enron. So you're close. Can you give us a possible date, a month, a year?
Well, I'm hoping early next year. I'm hoping we'll see it by, you know, after January. We're going to go through the last little bit. Martina and I are working on the last round of the edits for some things, and hopefully soon. I'm really hoping to be able to announce and promote it during our Workplace Promise Institute conference, which is dedicated to this kind of topic, and that we'll have a book soon.
I hope so. Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. I really am. As you know, I spent 10 years in a dark hole because it shattered my worldview and it shattered my identity. And it took that long to piece the little pieces that were so shattered back together again. So I'm really looking forward to this book. I think it's just going to be a bestseller. I really do. Because nobody else has addressed it, Jackie. No one.
Well, I'm hoping what we're addressing is the ability to evaluate whistleblowers for the psychological damage that is caused by the retaliation, and to help attorneys work with clinicians like social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and build a case that does hold accountable perpetrators.
I love it. I really, really love it. And it also would explain maybe to attorneys the mental state of a whistleblower, because as you know, attorneys sometimes are a little leery of whistleblowers because they come on pretty strong and vocally they can go on for days telling you about the trauma. So it can, I hope, set out why that occurs.
Right.
And what a whistleblower is going through, because I think people need to know that, you know, the person isn't crazy. No. They're just caught in this state where their whole world has been turned upside down.
And one of the things we know about trauma, one of the things we see commonly with combat veterans is the reliving and the reenacting of the experience. So, you know, I remember somebody at the VA made a comment about, whistleblowers, they become professional at whistleblowing and they run off and complain to Whistleblowers of America. And I thought, well, yes, you created that trauma. You created that victim mentality.
Right.
So that's what you get. You get people who are reliving their trauma. So they are hyper-vigilant, they're hyper-alert, they're ruminating because of the gaslighting. So they see this over and over again, and they're fighting it over and over again, and they're reliving their experience over and over again because you didn't believe them in the first place. If you would take these complaints seriously, believe the whistleblower, and even if the whistleblower is not 100% correct about the situation, instead of shunning them, treating them like an outcast, ostracizing them, devaluing them, marginalizing them, counter-accusing them, instead of doing all of these negative things, what if you like thanked them and brought them in and had them help you look at an investigation, be part of solving a problem, instead of, you know, all of this mislabeling, antagonizing, making this adversarial, because as soon as it becomes adversarial, there's going to be no winning, not for the organization, not for their clientele, not for the employee. And we can avoid a lot of this very negative, counterproductive absenteeism, you know, all the things that happen when you misalign your organization. You can avoid a lot of that by just helping the whistleblower. You know, when we've talked about the VA, there's something that the VA has a duty to assist a claimant in developing their claim. That's when a veteran files for benefits, the VA is supposed to help them. Why not do the same thing for whistleblowers? Why not help them develop their cases?
And amen, sister. I mean, really, you are on this. Why is the VA, if I've heard complaints about an agency, from whistleblowers. It's the VA. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me from the complaints I've heard from VA whistleblowers that they're just darn right damn punitive to their whistleblowers. What is the reason for that? I mean, they are awful.
So first of all, the VA is the largest federal agency in terms of how many people it employs, besides the DOD with its military and civilian federal employee, you know, levels of employment. But so you have a lot of VA employees. One, you have people in professional and ethical positions, but then you have these very siloed fiefdoms across the country. And every medical center director is responsible for their own world. So they can get away with a lot. And we see, like, one of the biggest problems I see with the VA police department is VA police report to a medical center director. So the kingpin at the top of the organization, who is very vested in not having, you know, we've talked to Bruce Sackman, medical serial killers, any kind of drug diversion, theft, abuse of patients, on his or her watch, nobody wants that. So when the police come in to run an investigation, they have to go through the medical center director. They don't get to go directly to the Department of Justice and file a case and get a prosecutor involved. They have to get permission first from a medical center director, from a chief of police. And something I've learned about the chief of police, it's an admin position. It's not a law enforcement position. So they don't really know law enforcement in the same way that these boots on the ground police officers know law enforcement. So there's a real ability to disconnect from them. The VAOIG only recently got subpoena authority. So they've not been able to continue investigations. And I mean, we even saw this at the DOD. All you have to do is transfer or move somebody, and that can end an OIG investigation because they no longer have jurisdiction over the person they're investigating. So that's a problem. The OIGs, they only make recommendations. There's no teeth. There's no enforcement to that. This Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection at the VA, the OAWP, I've now testified 4 times about, has been extremely dysfunctional. It's gone through multiple levels of leadership. And even though if the current leadership wanted to do all the right things, there's so much bad blood that would need to be undone. I don't know if that's even possible. And again, it's the VA investigating the VA. So right. They're sending complaints right back to medical center directors, or they're investigating people and, again, making recommendations to the secretary. Where is the forcing function? Where's the accountability? Where's payments to the judgment fund? None of that is happening.
That's so sad, isn't it? I've heard complaints from veterans, and I just shake my head. I often wonder if there is a retaliation Bible that these federal people can go to, because you hear the same story over and over, mm-hmm. you know, diminishing the employee, whether it's the CIA, the FBI, DOJ, any of them, they all seem to be taking it out of the same book. Mm-hmm. Have you found that to be true in your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the 70s, they called it the Malik Manual. Richard Nixon wanted to get rid of all the disloyal employees. Sound yes. familiar? So he created yes. a template for how you could fire government employees and force them into psych evaluations. We see that still happening. And I think it happens because it's easier to cover up the wrongdoing than it is to admit it and fix it.
Correct.
They would rather, you know, sort of die on their swords. And that's why I think the counterfactual then is true. If there's a playbook on retaliation, then there's also a playbook on how that taxonomy can be judged. So when I talk about things like gaslighting and shunning and mobbing and marginalizing and devaluing and blacklisting, or career blocking is what we prefer to call it, the counter accusations, the double binding, those are all the facets that we believe play into this code book of retaliation. Yes. And it's the same in the private sector. I mean, government employees are not unique. We see the same thing happen. You know, if you're a doctor or nurse and you report Medicare, Medicaid, cherry picking and lemon dropping and overbilling and overcoding, you see the same kind of retaliation. So that if the playbook for how to get rid of the whistleblower exists, then the playbook for fighting back is, I think, what we need.
And that's what you're writing?
Yes.
I love it. I love it. So tell me how you set up Whistleblowers of America, because it's really turning out to be a juggernaut in the field. I'm delighted, but you're still one person. So how are you handling this? Because, you know, the need for whistleblowers to talk to people is very urgent. Mm-hmm. And you seem to be the person that everyone directs whistleblowers to. So how are you able to handle all this?
So that's where we created the Workplace Promise Institute, which is our conference and retreat for whistleblowers and for what we hope to see as an emerging new profession, is a whistleblower protection advocate. We want to see more and more people enter the space. We want to see it professionalized. We want to see people build careers around advocating for whistleblowers, because I think that is sort of a missing piece to the puzzle. We see peer support programs, peer support specialists, again, with the police, with veterans, with mental health issues, with cancer patients, with military survivors. We know peer support models work. We want to train and educate on that in this space, and hopefully build out an entire cadre of people who are willing to assist. I mean, I definitely have a network. So if somebody contacts me, so if like an FBI agent called me, I'd say, hey, I know this great lady who is an FBI whistleblower, and I think you should talk to her. And I would send you an email, and I would say, hey, Jane, I just talked to this guy. He's got a case, very interesting. I think he needs somebody to walk him through. And that's what we do. I mean, I've connected correction officers to correction officers, VA police officers. We have so many of them that we started a little group so that we can meet every week and talk. I've got international whistleblowers. I've got people in the UK, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, France, I mean, Italy. We connect with people all over the world. And if they have a common story that they share with another group, like we get a lot of doctors, we get a lot of nurses, a lot of social workers. We try to match them up. If somebody's got like a child welfare case, we focus on what was the whistleblowing about? Was it a federal case? Was it state? Is it a QI-TAM case? Is it going to the SEC? And we try to help match people up, because when you do that, you can help problem solve, make decisions, be resilient, talk about what it's been like for your family to go through this. I talked to somebody the other day. He said this has been his whole adult life. He's known nothing else but living under this rubric of whistleblowing. So we see where that can really impact children and families and marriages. And we need to connect with each other and talk about those kinds of things.
Excellent. Excellent. And tell us more about this Workplace Promise you have coming up, because this is the first time I've ever heard of something like this being developed and done.
Yeah. So the Workplace Promise Institute is focused on the psychosocial impacts of whistleblower retaliation and advocacy and making the workplace right for right doing. So we want to focus on those issues, and we want to do our 10 hours of training. So we came up with a minimum of 10 hours for peer support that involves understanding whistleblower laws, understanding what is retaliation, understanding the skills of peer support. So like building rapport, being non-judgmental, being able to reflect, understanding suicidality and being able to assess and ask people those hard questions, building resilience, maintaining that relationship and that contact, and getting somebody through a difficult time in their lives. And then understanding, what is it to make a workplace promise? What does right doing look like? What does advocacy look like? How do you get to those next steps? How do you build a new normal? How do you reinvent? Or sometimes I'll say to somebody, so how are you going to reset? You know, when we talk about what does the reset look like? How do you even hire an attorney? I mean, that is not intuitive. That can be overwhelming.
Right.
So all of those things are what we're hoping to build into our 10 hours. So the Workplace Promise Institute will take place September 7th, but with most of the day being on the 8th and the 9th is going to be the core of our curriculum. We also have a Native American church coming in that's going to help us do some of the retreat activities. So we're going to do yoga on the beach and drum circles and sound bath and have opportunities to reflect and share those experiences as well. And then our goal is to also provide continuing education units, CEUs, for clinicians. We've partnered with the University of West Florida, and we're working with them to get our agenda certified so that people can come to the conference and get their CEUs. So we want social workers and psychologists and clinicians and lawyers who need CLEs to be able to come and get the credentials that they need for their profession. And so that is really where I feel like we need to evolve. I'd like to think this is more than just whistleblower storytelling. This is really about instilling hope and healing in a community that I think has been long misunderstood and ill-represented by the mental health profession.
I totally agree with you, Jackie. Totally agree with you. And I hope to join you there if my schedule works out. I think it's just a super, super thing to hold. And how does somebody, if they're listening to this, how do they apply to go?
Yeah.
How is it going to work? Where is there an application?
So we have it on our website for www.workplacepromiseinstitute.org. And we have that is our website totally devoted to all things conference and education and training. So you can register on the website, and we have sliding scales, everything from a general admission of 250 down to, we also have a virtual component and student discounts, veteran discounts. We try to make it as accessible as we possibly could. But we also still need to be able to pay some of the speakers, pay for some food, pay for the CEU credits. The University of West Florida charges fees. So we're trying to do all of these things and just set it up in such a way that it is as accessible to as many people as possible.
It's amazing, Jackie. And you obviously saw the need. And it's been close to going on 25 years for me. And I am so grateful for you establishing Whistleblowers of America, dealing with people who have experienced trauma. There was a real need there, and you saw it. And you obviously were successful in your fundraising. So you got other people to see the need, which is astounding.
Yeah, I mean, I keep saying we're the little train that could. We're not big famous law firms. We're not well-funded by big corporate sponsors. I would love for somebody to make my day easier. I'd love to be able to hire case managers and pay for some of the things that we rely on our volunteers for, but we're just not there. And I so appreciate the people who believe in our mission enough that they spend hours and hours and hours of their day, of their week, they're willing to connect and help each other out. I mean, that's where my faith is in this community. I know that there could be very cantankerous moments and difficult conversations, but at the end of the day, we have to do what we're doing to bring each other together and really support each other in the work that we're doing.
And you and I really are close in embracing that cause, bringing whistleblowers together, providing support for them, because I, like you, believe that that's where it's at, where the solution to the problem is, bringing whistleblowers together. And it's so good for the whistleblowers, for our movement. And I'm just so grateful to you, Jackie, for what you've been doing. What are your future plans? Where do you see yourself heading?
Well, I ideally will have a cadre of whistleblowers that are going to get certified, are going to get the training, are going to want to do this. And that law firms will want to hire whistleblower protection advocates to help their clients get through these difficult times. That mental health clinics will do the same. I'm sure you've worked in the past with the OVC, the Office of Victims Assistance. We need an OVC for whistleblowers. We yes. need to see the crime victims and the white collar crime victims who are retaliated against, discriminated against, harassed, have that same level of support. OVC provides grants, and mental health clinics hire ombuds and advocates that can go to court with a crime victim. So if you've been sexually assaulted, victim of domestic violence, all of those things can come together for you, but not when you're a whistleblower. And so that's my hope, is that someday we'll have whistleblowers who are seen in the same way that other crime victims are seen and treated with the same dignity and respect.
Oh, I hope so, Jackie. You're just preaching off the same hymn book that I have. And, you know, one thing I really wish we could bring about is to have a whistleblower be in the courtroom when another whistleblower is going through it, no matter where they're at in the United States or overseas. Just yeah. to have, you know, if we could have whistleblowers, a whistleblower or whistleblowers show up and be there in the courtroom, that would help so much. I mean, I really, that's my dream, is that someday exactly. that will happen. Exactly. And that's where you're headed. I'm so excited for you.
Yeah, that's so that there's somebody who is focused on the whistleblower. Somebody, again, I know the attorney does a lot of prepping a client for a deposition, but the hand-holding that is necessary, the right. talking through the emotional issues, the talking about, so how's your family doing today? Who's watching your kids while yes. you're here?
Yes.
You know, that person who cares about the life of the whistleblower, their mental status, are they getting the treatment that they need? How are they coping with the stress of this case? And answering those questions and helping them do that preparation. You know, not having that anxiety when you're in the courtroom, not having that anxiety when you're doing depositions, or understanding what are interrogatories and admissions, what is discovery, what's the difference between discovery and a FOIA, so that when these things are coming up, you have somebody you can ask, that you don't have to feel intimidated by asking, because they're like you, they're not the attorney, they're right. not vested, and you know, they're not vested in the case the way a law firm might be or might not be vested in your case.
Exactly. That would be so wonderful. I can remember sitting in court and I had executive FBI people get up on the stand and perjure themselves, which to me was a mortal sin. Mm-hmm. And I was gripping my lawyer's knee so hard that he sustained serious bruising. But, you know, he, mm-hmm. and you're right, lawyers are there for a reason, but for a whistleblower to be subjected to like perjury or false testimony on the stand, mm-hmm. it very few people understand that.
Right.
Very
and
few.
I remember once going to an MSPB hearing with he was a senior person with lots of years of government service, smart, I mean, just a smart guy, right? Experienced, smart, not some young junior GS, you know, 12. He was senior. And so he was sitting and he had all these books and he had all this stuff out on the table in front of him. And then the government came in, two attorneys, the labor management official from HR, the paralegal, and a witness. And then the five of them sat at one table and this one guy sat at the other table.
Yes.
And I did my best to scooch myself as close to him as possible.
Yes.
And I was writing notes and trying to hand him things. And, you know, the judge shushed me a couple of times.
Yes.
And then finally she said to him, and he was getting tired. He was getting confused. He was flipping through all these binders. He didn't know how to ask a question. So they kept objecting on the other side that he was testifying, not so very hard to represent yourself
very
in these situations. So, I mean, and I was like from the back seat, but without any authority to be there for him, I was just sitting in the back trying to answer his questions or helping him answer questions and ask questions and coach him as much as I could without, you know, the judge yelling at me.
Yes, which they can do. But I guess that's something that only a whistleblower can really understand in their day in court is the feeling of being so alone and so misunderstood. And that's why I hope someday we'll have whistleblowers that will show up or some of your trained advocates who can support whistleblowers in some of these court proceedings, because they are horrific for the whistleblower. They're
but
not
it
easy.
It has to be a profession. I mean, I love what I do and I do it as a volunteer. When I go into court, I do it as a clinician and I do charge for that. But we need to professionalize this. We need people to be on payroll. Like we shouldn't all be volunteers doing this with the lawyers making the money and not the advocates, because we won't reach mental health parity without it. We need to have this become an emerging profession. We need colleges to give credit for it. We need organizations to hire and make this so.
So Jackie, is that where you're heading? Is that your,
I hope so.
Is that your structure that you're aiming for?
I pray that someday that's what we can do, is actually employ people who are advocates that can go with the whistleblower and be part of their court proceedings with them.
So how do people donate to your cause?
So you go to our website, www.whistleblowersofamerica.org. We have a donate right up on top. You can write us a check. Our address is 11130 Lillian Highway, Pensacola, Florida, 32506. That address is also on our website. If you don't want to use the electronic means of doing a donation, but we welcome donations any type, any kind, anywhere, any way. And please register for the Workplace Promise Institute, www.workplacepromiseinstitute.org, and come join us and come see.
Jackie Garrett, you are someone special. And it has been an honor interviewing you today. You are on a flight plan that I hope is super successful because it's needed. And bless you and bless this program you're instituting. I hope to see you in September.
Well, Jane, thank you. We wouldn't have this flight path if it wasn't for people like you who paved the runway.
Bless your heart. You take care, my friend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Whistleblower of the Week, a program hosted by Whistleblower Network News. Please consider making a donation to support programs like this. Visit whistleblowersblog.org/support for more information.